John, welcome to Montana Public
Thanks,
Radio.
Thanks, Eric. Really appreciate you having me on here. It's great to be in Missoula.
I'm new to Montana. What's important for me to understand about this state?
Montanans are more outdoors people than virtually any state in the country. And we've got the highest percentage of fishing licenses, highest percentage of hunting licenses. We're outdoors people, whether you hunt, fish, hike, boat, camp, ski, all of that. That's why people are in Montana. I mean, frankly, that's part of putting up with the many months of winter that we have here in Montana. It's our outdoor heritage. There's an idea going around to transfer federal public lands to state control. And it's an issue that we're really highlighting in this campaign, that we not only need to protect our public lands, let's further protect public lands in Montana. It's part of a $6 billion industry, and it's part of our fabric, way of life in Montana.
This year's the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, and I'm wondering what you think that law's impact has been on Montana, and do you support expanding, creating more wilderness in Montana?
Mm-hmm. Well, we haven't had any new wilderness in Montana since 1983, and there are some common sense proposals out there that I strongly support. One of them, of course, is the North Fork Watershed Protection Act up in the Flathead to permanently protect the North Fork that feeds the crown jewel of Montana, Flathead Lake. Everybody supports it. Our entire delegation, including Congressman Steve Daines, got it passed through the House. I support that strongly. I support the Rocky Mount Front Heritage Act, which would add new wilderness, and that's a proposal that came from the ground up among ranchers, wilderness advocates, and others, and they brought it to politicians. They brought it to the delegation to carry it. Those are the kinds of things that I support. I also support Senator Tester's Forest Jobs and Recreation Act, which would add new wilderness in the state. Those public lands is a huge part of our economy. It's part of our way of life, and I definitely support responsible protection of more wilderness.
So on the topic of public lands, your opponent is calling for legislation to require local government officials to sign off on proposed land management decisions on federal public lands before those can be implemented. Would you vote for a bill like that?
Mm-hmm. No, that's not the solution. Look, the idea about transferring federal lands to state control comes about because of frustration of federal management of our federal lands. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, the Forest Service, BLM, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, because of budget cuts, they often have their hands tied behind their backs. And so we need to look at that as Congress and see what's not working and give them the tools necessary to manage the lands better. There are also efforts to prevent almost any timber sale in Montana. And let's look at that, too, and let's make sure that there's a responsible process so that we can have responsible timber sales in this state. The answer to managing those lands better is giving the federal government the resources to do that in a better way. The solution is not giving control over those lands to the state or locals, because we don't have the resources to manage the lands. 26 million federal acres, when you think about firefighting costs alone, wildfires, it's a huge cost to the state. And what we've seen in other states is when you hand over that local control, state control, that it does lead to a sell-off. You look at Texas, for instance, 96% of land in Texas is privately owned. 96%. You pay exorbitant fees to hunt, fish, access outdoor opportunities. And so we don't want that in Montana. We can't let it happen in Montana.
This proposal strikes me as maybe a compromise position, that there are those people that really want to sell off the federal lands and have only local control. Mm-hmm. Others think that the Fed should be in charge of managing those public lands. Mm-hmm. The idea that local officials should have a say and be able to sign off on those decisions made by federal land managers, mm-hmm. what's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with locals having input in it, but that's appealing to folks that do want to sell off the lands and put that control of the lands in private hands, which would limit access to regular people in Montana. And that just is not what the vast majority of Montanans want.
How do you think the federal government's doing it, managing endangered species like wolves and grizzly bears in Montana?
That's an issue where we do know on the ground what's going on, and it involves several different groups: farmers, ranchers, the Forest Service, the local government, hunters. that is an issue where we need collaborative solutions efforts. And for instance, the sage grouse is a hot issue this past couple of years in Montana. And the last thing that Montanans want is the sage grouse listed on the Endangered Species Act. We need to find the best solution we can here in the state to manage endangered species.
I guess the issues coming up of giving state officials the ability to manage grizzly bear populations in Montana, is Montana ready for that?
I'm not sure. I'm not an expert on managing grizzly bears, but we need to do the best job we can in terms of managing habitat for grizzly bears. I know one issue that has come up in this campaign from my opponent that he talks about a lot is up north in northwest Montana, Libby, and a proposed mine up there, the Montanore Mine. And he says what happened to Libby is the federal government, and the Montanore Mine is a proposal to drill under the Cabinet Mountains that is a prime habitat for grizzly bears. And so it's complicated in terms of economic development and management of those species in Montana.
Montana, as you know, only has one seat in the U.S. House, one among 435. Mm-hmm. So how do you use that one seat to affect any kind of change in D.C.? And how is your past work experience or life experience prepared you to be part of a body like that and make the most use of Montana's single seat?
Sure. Well, it won't be easy. And if I'm fortunate enough to serve, I'll be one of 435 members. But Congress has a 9% approval rating, 9%. And the American people can see that Congress is not tackling the tough issues. And I think part of the solution of getting Congress working again, working on things that affect and improve the lives of every congressional district in the country, is getting back to issues that, to me, are not partisan. And it's investing in education. It's investing in workforce development. It's investing in infrastructure. These things that we see the federal government has a proper role in helping those in rural areas like Montana. And if I'm fortunate enough to be there, I will seek out people that share that vision, that see that there's a urban-rural divide, that we need advocates that know what life is like in a rural place like Montana, and that we need investments in something like infrastructure to responsibly have economic development in a state like Montana. I don't have a silver bullet to break the gridlock. Everyone that runs says that they're going to break the gridlock back there. But the problem is that it's a constant campaign. That's what it is. And it's driven by too much money in politics and made worse by the Citizens United decision. And you can be guaranteed that if I'm fortunate enough to serve here, the pressure on me to turn around and raise money right after that and try to get reelected will be large. That's what it's become about. And I don't have all the solutions to break that cycle, but I believe that the biggest factor of creating that dysfunction, causing people not to work together, is money in politics, because people are motivated on campaign contributions, getting reelected, rather than doing what's right and voting on solutions to these problems.
Do you support public financing of elections to even the playing field?
Well, it's funny. I was at an event a couple nights ago, and there was somebody there that lives in Montana but is originally from Great Britain, and they have, I think it's 6 weeks of campaigns. And I think a lot of Montanans, a lot of Americans would find that appealing, to limit campaigns to that amount of time. You look at the last election, 2012 in Montana, where you had Senator Tester and Reberg fighting for that Senate seat. Over $50 million was spent in that Senate race alone. $50 million. I mean, that was five times what had ever been spent in a political race in Montana. And most of that went to negative TV ads. The average Montanan from September to Election Day that watched 2 hours of TV per day saw 1,200 ads per person in the Senate race alone.
So does that mean you'd support public financing to even the playing field in campaign spending?
I actually would. We need a solution that breaks that endless cycle of raising money. I'm very proud of the fact that we've done this, in my opinion, the right way. Over 70% of the contributions I've raised are from individual Montanans. And my opponent in the race, over 70% has been raised from out of state. And I think that shows the priorities. I mean, I'm raising money from people that care about Montana, that live here and care about Montana issues.
You talked about the need to find other folks in the House to work with if you get mm-hmm. there. Are there members of the House who are currently serving now that you look forward to working with, or you know, members of Congress that are serving now that you mm-hmm. Admire or look at as role models for how you'd like mm-hmm. to serve?
Mm-hmm. Well, I talked to one the other day, a guy named John Carney from Delaware, and he's a moderate guy, and he's an at-large representative. They have one seat in the House, and he's given me good advice in this campaign, and he's somebody that is there for the right reasons, to try to find solutions to all these problems, not there for partisan reasons to get reelected. He told me the most frustrating thing about serving in Congress today is that everyone there virtually knows basically what we need to do on so many of these issues: immigration, the deficit, health care. And you even talk to two other members of the other party, and yeah, that is what we need to do. But when it comes down to voting, no one is willing to take those votes. That's a madhouse, and the American people can see that people aren't willing to have the courage to make those votes. So that's one, and other people, like-minded Western type representatives, is who I would seek out.
Per capita income here is among the lowest in the country. There are people here that feel like the recovery is lagging in Montana, not going as fast as it is in other mm-hmm. states. So, sure. So what needs to change in the economy mm-hmm. to create more economic opportunity for Montanans?
Sure, sure. Well, we've fallen dramatically down the list of in terms of per capita income over the last five decades. I think in the 50s we were in the top 10, and now we're 48th or 49th. Our population hasn't kept up with other states, but there are solutions that I see in terms of creating better, good long-term jobs in Montana, and they are things that we need to invest in, frankly, because there are companies that are in Montana right now that are going gangbusters. I was just talking to a guy yesterday in Lewistown. He's got a company there called Speka Welding, and they make platforms to do repairs to F-15s and F-16s, and they need welders. He said, I could expand dramatically, but there aren't high-skilled welders available in Montana. You can't train them fast enough. Well, there's an area that we can invest in workforce development, a combination and partnership between businesses, the university system, and the federal government, frankly, to give people the skills necessary. And those are the kinds of investments that I want to see. If you're a company that's looking at Montana right now to relocate Montana, why would you want to relocate to Montana? Well, it's because of what we have. It's the outdoors. It's the way of life. It's the wonderful people we have in Montana. But you're going to look at things like the labor force. Do people have are there enough skilled workers? Is the infrastructure available in terms of broadband in rural areas? And those are huge challenges for companies wanting to do business in Montana. So that tells me we need to invest in infrastructure and education to give people the skills necessary to fill those jobs. The jobs are there.
So where does the money to make those investments come from? Because it's mm-hmm. not my impression that Congress is really in the mood to spend a lot of money on new programs.
That's right. And that's what I mean. It needs to be a partnership, a combination of different things. And that's actually going on right now. It's in Great Falls the other day. They have a welding program there at the Great Falls College of Technology. And they have a partnership, a class specifically to train people for jobs with an ADF, a steel company, up there. And so that's an example that federal government has provided some funding for the school. The school itself is providing the education, and the company is investing in that individual program through grants so that they can get those workers that go right into have the skills necessary to fill those jobs.
There's also a significant pay gap in Montana mm-hmm. between men and women. Mm-hmm. Is it time for federal legislation to address that?
Well, I think that when it comes to the minimum wage, over half of the people, Americans, that make minimum wage in this country are women, over half. That is reason enough to me to raise the federal minimum wage. It has not kept pace with inflation.
But do we need specific legislation to try to close the pay gap between men and women beyond raising the minimum wage?
We do need to find ways to level the playing field, because women for too long have made far less than men. And so I don't know what specific legislation you're referring to, but I would support efforts to level that playing field.
Do you support President Obama's response to the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and Syria? Mm-hmm. And what do you think Congress's role should be in dealing with that issue going forward.
Right. Well, I've been asking throughout this campaign as travel around Montana, Montanans, what they think of what the scary stuff going around the world. I mean, it's Iraq, Syria, Iran, North Korea, Ukraine. And Montanans tell me that they're very wary of us continuing to get involved in policing the world and these endless quagmires that have no end in sight and have endless costs. I believe that Congress has a constitutional responsibility to debate this issue and authorize use of force. And when the president announced airstrikes in Iraq and Syria, my opponent in this race said that's not enough, immediately called for sending in thousands of ground troops into Iraq and Syria. I don't think that's the responsible solution. We've been at war in Iraq for 10 years. We've spent over $2 trillion in Iraq. 4,500 Americans have lost their lives, including 28 Montanans. And so these are questions we need to talk about, debate. And what's the objective? What's the long-term objective? And I want to make one more point. Something that I often hear about the solution is that, well, we'd rather fight them in the deserts of Iraq than here at home. It's much more complicated than that. They estimate there's 1 billion Muslims in the world, 1 billion. And out of that 1 billion, 15 to 20% are Islamic extremists, jihadists, want to do harm to the West, to America. If it's 15%, that's 150 million Islamic extremists. And they're not all concentrated in that one area. They're in many countries. And so I'd like to see countries in that region, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, others, take a more active role and step up and be more the solution to the problem. Why is it our responsibility to police what's going on in the Middle East?
So in your eyes, to this point, Congress has not taken an active enough role in the response to that crisis?
Absolutely. They need to have the courage to debate the issue. It's been pushed in the House, at least, past the election, whether to have a debate on it. And they need to fulfill their constitutional responsibility, have the courage to discuss this issue. I want to know how much it's going to cost. What's the long-term objective here? Because I don't want to see us make the same mistakes we've been making for the last 10 years in Iraq.
What's your assessment of the government's response to the Ebola situation?
Well, I think it's a huge commentary on three areas. Number one, it's a commentary on our public health system. Our public health system in America is a source of great pride going back many, many years. We come up with things like a vaccine to polio and penicillin and other things like that. We need to lead with our public health system. We can't even get a Surgeon General approved in the Senate because of politics, and we've seen budget cuts to our public health system. So let's lead again when it comes to our public health system. Number two, it's a commentary on our healthcare system. You look at the millions of uninsured Americans in this country, including 179,000 Montanans. If you have an outbreak like Ebola or whatever the next outbreak is, you look at the 70,000 Montanans that would have been covered under the Medicaid expansion. If you don't have insurance, are you going to get checked for one of these outbreaks or when that spreads? Probably not, and making the situation much, much worse. And third, we have fallen way behind in the world in terms of research for all sorts of diseases. I was up at the McLaughlin Institute the other day in Great Falls, and they are doing world-class research there, trying to find cures to Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, other things like that. But they have trouble getting young people, any people, to get into the program because of the long-term commitment and because of the cost and because of the lack of funding for research. We've had such extreme cuts to the National Institutes of Health that helps fund institutes like that, that Americans, students are now leaving the United States and going to places like India and other countries where the funding is available to do that research. So we're falling behind when it comes to research to finding cures. That's been a source of pride here in America. So to me, it's scary, and it should be a real eye-opener to what our focus should be in terms of our public health system and healthcare in general.
You mentioned Medicaid. Has Montana made a mistake by not taking advantage or not signing on to the Medicaid expansion in the Affordable Care Act?
No question about it. And if we want to get into healthcare here, I mean, you'd start with the fact that there are millions of uninsured, like I mentioned, and many folks that don't have insurance get healthcare. You can go into the emergency room at community here, and you will be treated. And that cost is spread around to everyone else that has insurance and hospital costs. So that's number one. Number two, if you agree we need to do something about it, insure those millions of Americans that's driving up the cost of healthcare. Well, what's the solution to that? How are we going to insure those millions of Americans? The options are pretty limited, frankly. Either businesses hire folks and provide that insurance, or we force people that can't afford it to get insurance, maybe provide a subsidy, or we expand the roles of Medicaid and other government programs to get low-income folks on insurance. I just don't see a lot of other options. What I see, one of the tragedies of healthcare, is that now we have an endless debate of whether to repeal the Affordable Care Act or not to repeal. And in the process, we haven't seen any major improvements from the legislative branch in terms of our healthcare system and getting towards that goal of insuring more Americans separate from that legislation. So absolutely, it's a mistake not approving that Medicaid expansion in Montana. That's denying healthcare for 70,000 Montanans. Rarely does Montana do something, do an action to change the lives of that many people. 70,000 Montanans that do not have health coverage today because of that decision.
Healthcare is expensive. Extending healthcare Medicaid benefits to 70,000 Montanans costs money. Can America afford the Medicaid expansion?
It will be more expensive to continue on with people not being covered, because that is way more expensive in the long run in terms of not people not getting the care that they need early on, and people getting care that don't have insurance that dramatically drives up the cost of insurance and other healthcare costs in the system. The easiest way to save money in our healthcare system, the fastest way, is to insure all Americans. Every industrialized country in the world has asked themselves the question whether it's a right to have that insurance, and they've all answered in the affirmative, except the United States.
You've said in debates and elsewhere that the Affordable Care Act isn't perfect. What's wrong with the Affordable Care Act? What needs to change in the Affordable Care Act?
Well, for one, it was well-intentioned, and it was an attempt to do what I'm talking about in terms of ensuring more Americans, making some changes in the system. But it didn't fundamentally change our healthcare system. You hear people say, oh, is it government takeover of healthcare? That's just not true.
It didn't go far enough?
A lot of people wanted that, wanted more of a government role in healthcare to actually change the system.
What do you think?
Well, I think that the only way to ensure those millions of Americans, the government is going to have to play a larger role in that. And that's
right,
long-term.
Right.
That's long-term. And another thing you need to say about the Affordable Care Act is that no piece of legislation like that is going to instantly overnight change our healthcare system. This is a long-term problem that we have got to address. And my issue with the Affordable Care Act is that it addressed some things, but it didn't do enough to drive down the cost of care. It didn't do enough to provide more competition in the insurance market. We are seeing some positive things in Montana in terms of competition on the exchange. We've got three companies. That's competition driving down the cost of healthcare. 22 states have a co-op that was provided with a federal grant, not a handout. They have to pay back that. It's actually a federal loan. The co-op has to pay that back. In those 22 states, people are paying an average of 8% less on health insurance premiums in those 22 states compared to states that don't have a co-op. And you look at a state like Wyoming, they've got one insurance company providing insurance on exchange. They've got the highest rates in the country.
So yeah, I got maybe one more healthcare question for you. You've released a series of policy priorities for veterans, including helping vets get care at non-VA facilities, increasing the number of healthcare providers in the VA system, helping vets clear the backlog of their disability claims. All of that sounds like it costs money. How much do we need to spend to get veterans' healthcare to the place where it needs to be?
Number one, overarching thing is we need a culture change within the VA. And I put together a council and put together that plan based on their recommendation, Montana Veterans. And this is something that, that they described to me, that within the VA, that the burden is on the veteran to prove that they need treatment for that disability or whatever treatment it is that they need. That's backwards to me. I mean, if you hear it all the time, we need to keep our promises to our veterans. And veterans spend years and years. One, somebody on my council suffered from Agent Orange in Vietnam and spent decades trying to prove he's at a certain disability level. Think about how much that has cost over the many years. This is another area where if we invest up front, it will save money in the long, long term. You take mental health care and some of the injuries and things that people are facing returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, PTSD, especially in rural areas. And we're seeing hugely high suicide rates in places like Montana. Whereas if we invest up front with some of those issues and get people the care that they need, that will save money in the long term.
In the short term, it sounds like we need to spend significant amount of money to create the kinds of healthcare facilities that Montana veterans need and to clear the backlogs of their disability claims. You agree?
Well, if we're going to keep promises to our veterans, that's what it's going to take. This is also related to the question of what's going on in Iraq and Syria with ISIS and getting policing the world and getting involved in conflict after conflict. Why are we sending our men and women into new conflicts when we're not doing a good enough job of taking care of them at home currently? A
couple more issues I want to hit on. One, it looks like Montana's ban on same-sex marriage is on the cusp of being invalidated by the federal courts. If the ban is invalidated, is that good for Montana?
Absolutely. Absolutely it is. I mean, I grew up here in Montana. I'm 36 years old. I do not have a problem with two people that love each other that want to get married. I think that's a good thing. I think that's good for marriage. I think that's good for families and benefits. And I think that's a wonderful day for Montana if that's invalidated.
Do you think Montanans need to be concerned about climate change? And if so, what do you think the federal government should be doing about it?
The Pentagon released a report yesterday that said that climate change poses an immediate national security risk. The Pentagon's leading. Wall Street is stepping up and making efforts on it. We need people that want to be part of the solution. The debate is not going away. I'd like to see consistency from my opponent on this issue. I talked about this in the debate. He has gone from being somebody that recognizes we need to invest in renewable energy, cleaner forms of energy, recognize that climate change is here and man-caused activity is a big factor in that. He sent a letter to President Obama a few years ago calling on the president to do something about it and now says the science may not be correct. He's a climate change denier. We need people that...
If you're convinced of the science, what would you do about it? If you become a member of Congress, what does Congress need to do to take action on climate change?
Well, the first thing I did after the primary was release an energy plan that called for investing in renewable energy. We need to move towards a more cleaner energy portfolio in Montana, in this country. And we have resources right here in Montana in terms of renewables, wind, biomass, solar, hydro. At the same time, you got to recognize that traditional forms of energy are here, and there's thousands of jobs related to that. 53% of our electricity in Montana comes from coal. That's a fact. So are all those renewable energy sources the answer to our energy needs tomorrow? No, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't invest in them for the long term. And you see places like China that has some of the worst pollution in the world, in the urban areas, in the cities, and they are rapidly trying to develop renewable, cleaner forms of energy. It's here. We need to do something about it, and we need people that aren't going to put their heads in the sand on the issue and want to be part of the solution.
So on that issue of existing forms of energy, a lot of Democrats I talk to say that if we build the Keystone XL pipeline, that's really going to exacerbate climate change. It's a very dirty source of energy, and we should not build the Keystone pipeline because of its threat to the global climate. You support building the Keystone pipeline.
Mm-hmm. Well, I support it, but it needs to be done right. And when I say done right, we need to have an emergency response plan in place in case there is a spill. I recognize the concern that the pipeline could contribute to climate change, but this is a long-term issue, and we have huge energy needs in this country. You look at what's going on in Northeast Montana with the Bakken development and the infrastructure challenges there. One thing that isn't talked enough about the pipeline is the fact that if the pipeline were to be built, the benefit in terms of revenue for those counties that are facing extreme infrastructure challenges, law enforcement, jails are full, drug dealers, meth, heroin, all of that in Northeast Montana would provide some revenue to deal with some of those issues in Northeast Montana. But the pipeline needs to be done right. There needs to be protections for landowners. It needs to be made with the best possible American-made products. And there needs to be guarantees it is going to benefit American jobs.
So in terms of its benefit to the American economy, mm-hmm. There are those who say we should make its approval conditional on the oil that comes through that pipeline staying in the United States and not being mm-hmm. exported for sale, sending mm-hmm. that oil overseas. Mm-hmm. We should keep it here to have an impact on energy prices in America. Would you support that?
If your goal is energy independence, then the pipeline needs to benefit America. And I don't have all the facts on where the oil is going, but I do agree that if that pipeline is built, it needs to help America become more energy independent, not shipping the product around the world.
My understanding of your position on universal background checks for gun sales is that you do not support those. Is that accurate? Mm-hmm. And why not? What's the harm?
Montana has a strong tradition of Second Amendment responsible gun ownership, and I'm a strong proponent of the Second Amendment. That being said, what happened in Connecticut, Colorado, other places around the country, it's a national tragedy. I can't even fathom what has happened there as a father of an 8 and a 6-year-old. And my first question is, what would make somebody turn a gun on innocent children, innocent people? My first question is, what are we doing to address mental health care in this country? And so I don't think that just background checks and further background checks is going to address the underlying problem, which I think is mental health care.
So there are people out there who have a documented history of mm-hmm. mental health issues, mm-hmm. and right now no one does a background check on them when they go to buy a gun. Mm-hmm. at every gun sale, mm-hmm. and so you don't think that's a rational way to mm-hmm. address that issue?
Well, if it's the current system that's preventing that, then we need to look at that, what the current system and why that is not the case. But it's a big issue. It's complicated. It's not just, I don't think that's the only solution to solve gun violence in this country. I just don't understand why people take guns and do what they do and turn them on innocent people. And that to me is a mental health care issue, and that's where we should focus.
John Lewis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate being here. It's great to be in Missoula today.